Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. It's July 28, 2014. After putting my information together for tonight's show, the theme that shaped up is something I've talked about many times, it turns out, and that is lying. That includes what's called the big lie, in quotes and capital letters, and how often that the big lie is resorted to. That's something that we find discussed when we talk about the holohoax. And it goes all, lying, you know, when you think about lying, though, it's not something modern. It's certainly not something new. And it's so commonly resorted to. It goes back even, I always think of it, when I think about it, I immediately usually think about Adam and Eve. I guess the story of Adam and Eve made a big impression on me when I was younger, and I've never forgotten a whole lot of what's in Genesis and the story of how, you know, mankind got started. I think the idea that Adam, when he was asked about something he had done wrong, he lied in a sense and said, well, he did lie because he said, well, no, it wasn't my fault, and he blamed someone else. He blamed Eve. And that is something that I'm going to bring up as I talk about Vladimir Putin first thing, once I get going with the topic. And maybe lying is even found in the animal kingdom, huh? Because I think, well, all human beings are very susceptible to lying. It's something we all don't want to be responsible when something goes wrong, and or if we've even knowingly done something wrong and we thought we could keep others from knowing about, and then we end up lying about it. I mean, lies are just perennial. I thought, well, I wonder if there's any form of lying in the animal kingdom. Something to think about. Maybe some people have are aware of that there is, and that there's things have been written about it. I'd be interested in knowing. In any case, before we get into that, I want to go over a couple of items of interest. They are interest to me anyway, that came up. And one is about Alexa.com, which it seems to be all screwed up now when it's concerning CarolynYeager.net. It has my traffic coming 30% from Thailand. And that's been there for quite a few weeks now, so I guess it's not going to change. At first I thought, well, they'll correct this. But it only shows 45% of my traffic coming from the United States and 30% from Thailand. And the rest from the United Kingdom. So I would say that if anybody is interested in the actual traffic statistics to CarolynYeager.net, that they look at the globe, which I have on the front page of my website. And that keeps, as far as I can see, because it's always been functioning so well, keeps an accurate count of every visitor to my site. And it shows that if you click on that globe on the bottom right sidebar, it takes you to a page. And if you go to the page, there's different ways to see it. If you click on the one that says bars, it will show you this the percentage and the number from each country. And of course, the number one is the United States. I mean, my site is in the English language, so it's naturally going to be mostly English speakers who are going to be visiting it. It shows, and it has been very consistently, at least it's been consistent on this for quite a long time, that 53.5% of my visitors are from the United States. I think it used to be a little bit higher. And only 0.2% are from Thailand. That's 0.2% from Thailand. So, and 10%, number two is the United Kingdom, not surprising, with 10%. and 6.5% from Canada, 4.75% from Germany, and 3.2% from Australia, 1.7% from Sweden, and then following that is most all of the European nations before you get to something that's not European, although I think there's something stuck in there with the Europeans. But Thailand is number 34 on my list of visitors. So I think what Alexa has done is to bring the United States too low, the United Kingdom too high, and then lumped everything else together as Thailand, which is pretty crazy. I have nothing against Thailand. I actually know that there, I know a couple who has lived there at different times for pretty long periods of time and like it there. I think it was always their favorite place. There are people who lived around the world, retired young, and so on. And they had another friend couple who were friends of theirs who lived in Thailand too. I think there's a lot of British and Americans and so on who live in Thailand and like it. So I'm not surprised. I would have. I wonder if these people have ever found my site. I'm not surprised that I would have visitors from Thailand, and they're certainly very welcome, but I just knew it couldn't be that many. So, and I don't know if I'll ever get down below the 100,000 rank, which is supposedly, according to Alexa, is when they actually put out accurate data on you. Until then, it's estimated. Well, they had me estimated pretty well, but I was kind of happy to see another country added, but I'm not too happy that it shows that it's 30% of my traffic. But in any case, another thing I thought I'd bring up is an article I saw just in the last few days that many of you might have seen, talking about how the Turks are becoming hostile to Jews. And this story was put out, of course, by the European Jewish Press, but it was on Wednesday that a pro-government newspaper in Turkey published an open letter by a man named Faruk Köse to Turkey's chief rabbi, calling on the Jewish community to apologize for Israel's actions in Gaza. And he made a statement that I thought was very good, so I wanted to read it on the air. And it also, this newspaper is supposed to be connected to President Erdogan in some way or in his camp. And this Faruk Köse, who wrote the letter, is also connected to him or a friend of his or, you know, supporter or something. And Köse wrote to the chief rabbi about the Jews, "You came here after being banished from Spain. You have lived comfortably among us for 500 years and gotten rich at our expense. Is this your gratitude, killing Muslims? Erdogan, demand that the community leader apologize." Well, it's interesting that he says that they've gotten rich at their expense, but they don't seem to mind having them there. But they care about, now this man is making it clear that what they care about is killing Muslims. They're Muslim. Their Turks are Muslim. And if they were killing whites, I guess they wouldn't care. They wouldn't be talking about it anyway. Or Christian whites and so on, they wouldn't be talking about it, but they're talking about the Muslims. And this is the way it goes for people who would be taking a lot of comfort from that and saying, oh, well, look at, they're going to get after the Jews on this. Good for them. And, you know, well, it is good for them. But they're doing it for themselves and their own people. They're not doing it for us and our people and our nation. So we have to do that ourselves. And we can't expect that they're going to care about what happens to whites, because they're not. Now, the article goes on to read, this person wrote, the IDF is using forbidden weapons, intentionally killing children and murdering Muslims for the sake of murdering Muslims. Hamas is unprepared to accept dictations from Israel and the U.S. and will only lay down its weapon after its understandings are accepted. So it's defending, sounds like it's defending Hamas, saying that they're not going to be dictated to by Israel and the United, or the United States, or and they'll only stop fighting when they're understood, or when they're listened to, when they're heard, and when what they want is accepted. So, and he adds that, then he says, while all this is happening, the Journal of the Jewish Community in Turkey, which is named Shalom, is this Jewish newspaper, is referring to the murder of children in Gaza as, quote, taking care of terrorists, unquote. So there's a lot of anger, as everybody knows. Of course, it's breaking out all over, but Muslims are angry, Muslims are acting up, Muslims are criticizing very strongly, but they're doing it because of Muslims. And white Europeans are all upset over what Israel is doing to the Palestinians also, and of course everybody should be, but they don't get upset over what Israel is doing to us in our own countries and in much more subtle ways. So, but that's just one little item there. So I'm starting out tonight with Vladimir Putin, and I'm calling him a bad guy. I like him less and less. I think I just about despise him at this point, but I still like looking at pictures of him. What is that about him? He's got a very, he's got that expressionless face, so that, and he's got a strong body, even though he's quite short, but he exudes a kind of strength and not so much confidence. That you don't see that because you don't see anything. He doesn't, he is expressionless and emotionless, as he tries to be in his, of course, I've seen pictures of him where he's not that way, but those are personal things. But when he's acting as head of state, he certainly is inscrutable. And he just has this look of power, I guess. And that is appealing to an awful lot of people. It became very appealing to the people over at Daily Stormer. It's kind of an act, although, it's also probably part of his life as a spy, as an intelligence officer for so long. And he learned to be that way, and he's got that demeanor still, and he's not going to give anything away. It's kind of like that. As I said, I like him less and less, and I like Russia less and less. I think all this business about Ukraine that's going on is doing absolutely nothing for Russia's popularity in the world. If they care about that, they might not. It might not even be all that important. But to me, it's clear as a bell that he's lying. This is what's bothering me, you see. I thought just about from the start that he's just bald-faced lying and intends to continue lying. I don't see how he would now say, oh, well, okay, I wasn't telling the truth all this time. He's not going to do that. And this fits the pattern of the Soviet Union and how they behaved, and particularly under Stalin way back when. But also there's that connection that Putin is upholding and rehabilitating Stalin and Stalin's policies because he was the leader in World War II. And we know what he's done about World War II revision and, of course, the Third Reich. That's understandable, but the Holocaust and that revisionism and so on, Nuremberg Tribunal, all that is just not, I just can't accept any of that. So for me, he's made himself the enemy, but also he's I see him as a liar. So the Russian and the Russian-speaking rebels in eastern Ukraine, who are loaded with all that heavy weaponry, where did they get that? Are in my opinion also lying. The whole thing is a big lie. I know I'm kind of amazed at the number of people who, well, it's not that there's a lot of people, but the ones who do, who communicate with me, still wanting to believe in Putin about all of this and think that it's a NATO plot, it's a U.S. Plot and so on, a U.S. Jewish plot. I just can't see that's the way it is, because it's just so obvious. When things are obvious, they're obvious. And we'll get into that more during tonight's program. So I need to move along. And no, so I'll just say that no matter what one wants to complain about, when it comes to the United States, the European Union, NATO, there's plenty to complain about. You don't have to be defending them in order to know that this doesn't excuse this outright bald-faced lying by Putin's government about this passenger plane tragedy. This is a real tragedy. And for them to, it shows something very childish in my estimation. I try to think of what it was, and I didn't spend a lot of time trying to come up with the right descriptive words, but the best I can really come up with is childish, which doesn't sound very strong, but just not taking it seriously, like not understanding, you know, what it's all about, and thinking that they can just lie their way out of it and they'll come out all right. I don't think so. So I say here, I wrote for myself, that it comes from a policy to always deny, even when it's not convincing at all, which to me is childish, and which cannot be the basis for relations between nations. So if you're a nationalist, one thing that has to be respected is that there's a certain amount of openness in diplomatic relations. And, of course, it's been said often enough that Putin is not a nationalist, and his government is not nationalist. So I don't know what category to put it in, but what comes to my mind all the time is the Stalin government. That's what comes to my mind. I don't think that he has the same kind of plans in mind, but they function on the same kind of, maybe that's Russian, maybe it's a Russian thing of secretiveness. It's a very secretive government that Putin has. Now, something that I read in a newspaper or in a our article online said this. The lies, I was talking about coming right out with those that they were lying, and the lie saying the lies have gotten more complex. The Russian fiction that a Ukrainian fighter jet had fired the missile ran into the problem that the jet could not fly at the altitude of MH17. Now, you know that they came up with that. They said, oh, there was a Ukrainian fighter jet that was flying around in that area, flying alongside, I even read, and could very easily have fired that missile, could have fired a missile. But then I read that was totally false and what the facts were. And a lot of people, some people sent me that very thing, saying that's something you should pay attention to, and without even, you know, looking further to see whether there's any truth in it. So there's lots of lies. I think there are a lot of websites that are actually the work of Russian intelligence. Of course, there's websites that are the work of U.S. intelligence and so on, and, you know, Israeli intelligence and all of that also. But they put out this stuff, and then there's ones that just like to put this stuff out anyway. because it gets them readers. A lot of these sites have advertising. You need to notice when they have advertising as to, you know, whether they're just trying to get as much traffic as possible so they can get ads on their site to make money. But anyway, it says that after this story came out that that those military jets couldn't fly high enough, those fighter jets, the Russian hackers then changed a Wikipedia entry to say that the jets could briefly do so. You see, now that's a fiction too. So they're just playing around trying to get away with anything they can. And this is all being done at the behest of the Russian government. And it says that the purpose of this, which I would agree with totally, the aim is not to persuade people to believe all these stories that were coming out to detract the blame away from the Putin's government for giving the weapons, sending the weapons, delivering the weapons into the eastern Ukraine and letting them be used there. And I do believe that they removed them immediately when they realized the mistake, the big error that had happened, and the repercussions from that. So that's the side that I'm on, and not because I'm taking sides, but because it's the only thing that makes sense to me. But it's not that they really think, in all of these cases, that they really think that that people are going to believe what they say, but they have to keep coming up with other stories and cast doubt to make the truth a matter of opinion, is what these people put it as, but to make it so that they can always say, well, no, it's not us. Look, it might have been this, it might have been that, it might have been something else. And some people will be saying, well, it might have been, and we can't prove it. And this is the purpose of these kind of fictions that are put out. In a world of liars, might not the West substitute? That's me. That's me saying that. Okay. My comment I want to make is that I see. I know. It's not me. I just said substitute revisions. I'm confused by my own notes here. The article said, in a world of liars, might not the West be lying too? That's the purpose of it. To say, well, if there's so many lies around, well, who says that we're not the only ones telling lies? The West would be telling lies too. And then pretty soon, you're supposed to not have anything to believe in. See, well, you can't believe anybody. So it's what we end up with today, which is the goal of so much of this, is to make people not be able to come to a clear understanding of what's going on, to always wonder about it. And I'm just saying that you could substitute revisionists for the West, because that's what the whole hoaxers want to do too, with all of the lies that they tell and the fictions that they make up, is to just say, well, they can't prove it. You know, nobody can prove anything. And so they might be lying too, or they are lying, the revisionists, which we're going to get to in this show. So let's see. On Saturday, I found this interesting. Russia's foreign ministry said that Washington shared responsibility for the crisis. So there was a story that Russia was saying, well, Washington and the U.S. Needs to take responsibility for this too, for what's happened in Ukraine and why the rebels are doing what they're doing and so on. And they said that the United States continues to push Kiev into the forceful repression of Ukraine's Russian-speaking population discontent. I thought, what a sentence. What a sentence that is. Saying that because the Russian-speaking population in Ukraine, in the east there, is discontented, and they have reacted in the way that they have, it's because they have been repressed by the government, the new government in Kiev, and the United States is assisting in that. And so the United States has to take equal responsibility for the for what these Russian-speaking rebels are doing. I think that's far-fetched, but that's the kind of thing that they try to do, the blame game. And so it says that the Obama administration has some responsibility both for the internal conflicts in Ukraine and for its severe consequences. You see how they get away in that, get away from talking about that plane where those innocent people were shot down. Because they were responding to the White House's accusation that Putin was culpable in the downing of the Malaysian plane. They don't want to be blamed for it. And what's interesting, most interesting here to me, is that the Germans getting into it. The Germans have been pretty much trying to be neutral and be supportive of Russia. But now that's changing, and German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has spoke out strongly in favor of the new EU sanctions against Moscow in an interview published on Saturday. And he said, quote, after the death, and this is exactly how I see it, you have to feel a little bit of emotion in this. Quote, after the death of 300 innocent people in the MH17 crash and the disrespectful roaming around the crash site of marauding soldiers, the behavior of Russia leaves us no other choice, he told a German newspaper, nor the choice but to increase the sanctions against Moscow. He said, we remain true to our course, cleverly calibrated and mutually agreed measures to raise the pressure toward a willingness to have serious talks with Russia, he said. You know, I would think that Putin, if he was smart, if right at the beginning, I thought his behavior was stupid. Right at the beginning, he should have been more open to the fact that it was the rebels who did it. Why he wasn't was because he didn't want it known that he had supplied, and you have to say it's him. I mean, it's his government, his intelligence service, supplied this big Buk missile launcher to the rebels, and they took it and they sent it down. They sent it across the border into Ukraine. See, that's serious, and that's what he's denying. And for that, he has to deny that the rebels did it because they didn't have one of those things. And the whole thing, it becomes impossible. And he's trapped in this now. And that's what happens with lies and liars. So in this case, to me, it's easier to see, but it actually has graver consequences than this business with the revisionists, which doesn't have such grave consequences, but it's interesting and important to many of us. So now I'm going to move on to say more on the day about David Cole than I did on Saturday. What I really want to do tonight is to make a better case, a clearer case. I really don't think I tried to make a case on Saturday, but I'm going to make something of a case for why the Treblinka gassing story, gas chambers, is just so bogus that it cannot be believed for an instant. And the people who are trying to push this story, and I'm going to name three people, David Irving, Mark Weber. Now, neither of them are really trying to push it too hard, but they've come out with it as their current belief. But they're not pushing it. That what happens is that they're questioned about it, and then they have to defend it, and then it gets controversial and so on. But the third one is David Cole, and all of these three people are considered revisionists, And they had been on the side of the majority of revisionists, and they hadn't, I guess, focused on Treblinka, so they hadn't put out what they thought about it, but I would, you just assume that they didn't accept any gassings. And then they started turning the other way. It started with David Irving, then Mark Weber followed David Irving, and now David Cole is following the two of them. And you, so the question is, why? What's the reason? And are they sincere? Do they really believe it? Are they lying about it? Do they know? I mean, do they know that it's untenable, but they're saying so anyway for reasons? So that's the overview kind of thing. And I'll just say now about David Cole, Geirmar Rudolph. I hope he doesn't mind me quoting what he said to me on over Skype this morning when I asked him if he'd like to come on tonight's show. I didn't think he would, and I really would kind of happy to make the points on my own because he doesn't really share all my views, and I don't know, he's not too interested in this. He told me that he has never read what Irving wrote or said about Treblinka. And he hasn't read what Cole has said either. And he's never done any serious, he says, Irving has never done any serious research into the issue, let alone published anything worthwhile, as far as I know, he says. And I'm not interested in unfounded ramblings. And on Saturday, he said of Tobin, he said of Cole to, Frederick Tobin said that, Geirmar Rudolph had said about Cole that he's neither a scholar nor an expert in the field in any terms. So, and he says that he would rather, he's working on publishing books and he's not interested in getting into these talks about these things. So, now on Saturday, I talked about Cole's Treblinka article, which has been published at, you know, Farrell House Publishers Facebook page. But I left out his two postscripts at the end of his article because I had too much else to talk about, and that wasn't what I was focused on Saturday. But I'm going to read them now because it is what I'm focused on tonight. And to that Treblinka article in which, you know, he said, oh, Treblinka, he can prove that there was, hundreds of thousands of exterminations that went on there because of this one sentence in the Corhair report. And he was talking about the Corhair report and the Hufla telegram, and all this proved it, that these Jews were transported there and never left, and just as what they all say. All the exterminationists say the same thing. So in his first postscript, he talked about Jürgen Graf, and in his second postscript, he talked about Eric Hunt. And I'll try to go through this pretty quickly because I'm going to use something by Jürgen Graf in refuting all this. So I thought it was relevant, and Cole wrote, in a piece on inconvenient history, Jürgen Graf, who is the Swiss revisionist who's associated a lot with writing books with Carlo Mattonio, and now also with the two of them with Thomas Kues, and he lives now, he's not living in Europe now because he was sentenced to jail time, which he didn't want to serve. So he's another one who's suffering a lot from the Holohoax lie and the Holohoax industry. But back to this, Cole writes that Jürgen Graf attacked David Irving in this article that was published at Inconvenient History. And this was quite a few years ago. I mean, a number of years ago, anyway. For his belief that mass murders occurred in the Reinhard camps. Groff's position is 100% dependent on the idea that if the Nazis did have four secret murder camps, the Nazi higher-ups would have been blabbing about them left and right to every underling and bureaucratic cog. Graf's view is that the Nazi leaders had no secrets and dispensed no information on a need-to-know basis. If Fritz Reuter, he is a person who is associated with the telegram and the Corhair report, and he's someone who, well, he's going to describe it here, but he had an involvement in these Jewish transports. If Fritz Reuter, an employee in the Department of Population and Welfare in the office of the Governor General for the District of Lublin, didn't know the nature of Belzec, if he believed it to be a regular camp, well then, gosh darn, it was, because the Nazi leaders never kept anything secret. Himmler, Goebbels, they were like WikiLeaks, everything out in the open, 24 hours a day. If you actually buy that, then you'll buy Groff's attack on Irving. You see how old Cole, he's gotten really nasty. See how he's presenting that, making fun of Groff's views. This is, you know, making it look as though he's saying exaggeratedly ridiculous things and making it all so simple-minded. And that if you therefore he's trying to throw Groff into disrepute as a serious revisionist. So maybe I should. Well, I already got that in there. Let's see if there's anything here. Okay. All right. I already said that. When Himmler, going on with what. Cole wrote in his first postscript. When Himmler received the Corhair report, he insisted that the term special treatment of the Jews be removed in the section regarding the general government evacuees. Through Brandt, Corhair was instructed to use the term processed through the camps in the general government instead. Himmler himself told Corhair that the report might be good in the future for camouflage purposes, but that for now it would be for his eyes only. Well, he's selecting things right here, Cole is. That much I know. He's selecting certain things to make it appear that that Himmler was trying to cover something up, trying to cover up the idea that special treatment of the Jews meant extermination. And actually, Metonio has written a whole chapter in a whole book that is something to do with that, but this whole chapter, which you can find at january27.org, in which he discusses the real meaning of special treatment of the Jews, which is not extermination at all, but I won't go into that right now. Cole goes on to write, if Himmler insisted on camouflage in a report that only he was going to see, doesn't that give some indication of the level of secrecy surrounding the evacuations? If he was that cautious with a document not distributed to anyone else, why would he be expected to scream the truth about the Reinhard camps to low-level bureaucrats? Again, his arguments are selective. He's trying to, you know, accuse people of things that he can then say, well, see, this doesn't make any sense. Whereas I want you to remember this, because at the end of tonight's program, I'm going to read something from, or at least it will probably be in the it won't be until the second hour. I'm going to read something from Robert Faurisson, in which when he made his trip to Treblinka, and what he has to say about the openness of that camp, and what I keep forgetting his name, wanting to call him Clark now. What Cole is saying over and over again is that these were top secret and nobody knew about them, and they had to keep everything super secret because this is where they were actually killing people in gas chambers. So going on, so keep that in mind. Going on, he makes a point number two. That's the end of his comments about Groff. And then in his second postscript, he turns to Eric Hunt, and he says, ever since my position on Treblinka became known, well-meaning revisionists have been pillaring me with instructions to watch, to, quote, watch Eric Hunt's Treblinka archaeology video. Watch it. Oh, just watch it. You'll see how wrong you are, unquote. Cole goes on to say, I have never met Mr. Hunt, and I have no beef with the young, unsuccessful elevator conversationalist, which I thought was unnecessary to say. And also, he wants to point out that he's young. Cole is now trying to position himself as one of the experienced revisionists who's been around for a long time, and you're leaving out that whole bunch of years after he recanted and disappeared and went off to be a big deal in Hollywood to get a different career, which he admits that he wishes he still had it. At least he admits all these things. There's something about Cole that he tells the truth, but he's trying to guide you in a, he tells lies along with it. So he's into the don't blame me thing, you know. It's somebody else has done it. Somebody else's responsibility. But he went off and did Holocaust, pro-Holocaust videos, and now he's back and he's acting like he's the old Eminence Grease of revisionism, practically. And I want to add in here that Frederick Tobin and I were both sorry that we forgot on Saturday to mention something that we had mentioned to one another before that, and that was, are there any pictures or are there any real believable records or reports of the damage that David Cole underwent in being beat up by the JDL. David Cole has talked about how he was attacked and beat up several times and all the bad things they did to him. And oh, I think he did say he lost some teeth. That might be true. We were just wondering, you know, if how you could prove that this actually even happened to David Cole, or if this was made up. I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying that we have those pictures of Robert Faurisson, how badly beat up he was with his bloody mouth, and that wasn't the only time he was attacked. And we know how these people are attacked, but we have never seen David Cole after he was attacked. He didn't. Because he was like hiding. He didn't come forth and say, look what these Jews did to me. He was already considering, I guess, going along with them and quitting, or did it even happen? Something I would like to get an answer to that from Cole. Can he show us some pictures? So then he says, to be clear, no, he says, I must confess there was little of value in Hunt's examination of the Smithsonian Channel's excavation, Treblinka excavation show. To be clear, that Smithsonian program was nutty as a bowl of pistachios. It was empty, meaningless, overwrought, and just plain dumb. There was nothing of value in it. It should rightfully be mocked, and I'm glad young Mr. Hunt invested an hour 20 in doing so. And yet I say, yet, you know, he's talking about how bad their program is, and yet he believes in its conclusions, or it believes in what it's saying. He believes in what it's saying, although he doesn't like what they're doing. How does he justify believing in that there are all these bodies were buried there, all these bodies were cremated there, all these ashes were created there, what happened to them, and so on? He has no answers to that. But, I mean, I think it's kind of strange that he will pan the Smithsonian program, which he really has to because it was terrible. And yet he's still going to believe in what happened, what they say happened there. So he says that, you know, he criticizes Hunt for for a few things. I don't want to spend too much time with this because I want to tell you that he finally says that Hunt is either a liar or a man with no actual comprehension of what he's speaking about. Well, it's interesting that he uses the word liar. It's funny how, you know, liars call other people liars, although I call people liars, so I better watch out with that, with saying that. But, and he accuses Eric Hunt of carrying out a fraud because of the 600,000 Polish Jewish refugees being found in Asia, Asiatic Russia, that he had in his video. And Eric has said already that was an error on his part, and it was brought to his attention, and he changed it, and he took it out and put something else in there. Just a few days after that video was first released, and he fixed that. And yet all the versions of it, some of them were still out there, and he didn't try to get hold of those, which he now realizes he should have, and he's now gotten rid of, however you do that, he's killed off all those bad ones, and he's got the right one. And so that was an error, an honest error that has been changed. That has been repaired. And the last thing I want to say here is that Eric Hunt has now posted his response to Cole. It's quite excellent, really, and it's very thorough, pretty long, but it's broken up with a lot of pictures, and he's done a very good job with it. And you can find it at his HolocaustHoaxMuseum.com site, and that would be HolocaustHoaxMuseum.com/response-to-David-Cole. Response to David Cole with hyphens in between. Holocaust Hoax Museum, all one word, .com. And that's there. You can read it now. And he answers David Cole quite nicely and tells you a lot of good facts about Treblinka. It's very highly recommended. So now I'm going to go to Jürgen Graf on Treblinka, and I just looked through a text that he has written on Treblinka, and I have taken out what I think is the most important part that would refute what David Cole says, the belief in Treblinka that David Cole has, and also David Irving has, and is saying he has, and also Mark Weber. Although it's kind of interesting that David Irving has been, I don't know what, he's been promising this book about Himmler for how many years now? 5 or 7 or something, and still hasn't been able to pull it together. And he's been talking about this Treblinka, his Treblinka theories, and he still hasn't published anything on that. So it's just talk. Obviously, it's full of holes, and he's not able to fill up the holes. So in any case, let's see what I've got here. Most important here is the mass deportations of Jews in the occupied Eastern territories, because this is what David Cole is talking about. He's talking about the transportation. This is what's taken from the Korher report and the Heflet telegram, that the that proves the transportation of 1.2 million Jews to all three or maybe four camps in these the revisionists called transit camps. And he is calling extermination camps, that it's proven that that Jews were transported there, and they were never transported. They never left. Graf has written that the German wartime documents leave no room for doubt that Treblinka was a transit camp. So he's just as certain on his side as Cole and is on his side. He says there's no room for doubt that Treblinka was a transit camp. And that the Jewish policy of the NSDAP aimed from the outset to move as many German Jews, to get as many German Jews to emigrate as possible. And to do that, they worked with Zionist organizations. And this turned out to be very slow. Trying to emigrate Jews with the help of the Zionists to Palestine, which is where the Zionists wanted them to go. But because the British disabled Jewish immigration to Palestine, it was very slow, and most German Jews preferred to go to other countries, especially to the United States. So the immigration to Palestine didn't work too well at all. And on August 26, 1938, a central office for Jewish immigration was set up under the leadership of Adolf Eichmann, and it was founded in Vienna, and then led by Reinhard Heydrich overall. And on February 11, 1939, there was established a Reich Central Office for Jewish Immigration, which was located in Berlin. And on 15th July 1939, before the Polish War broke out, Eichmann was given by Goering, he was given command to establish such a central location in Prague. So then Eichmann moved to Prague with this kind of a command post. And because of the Polish campaign, a large number of Polish Jews came under German rule following that. And so the Jewish question no longer could be solved by immigration. They had too many Jews then, because you know how many Polish Jews there were. A lot, like 3 million or something. So, or was it 6 million? They say 3 million were killed and 3 million survived, or it says that none survived. Did they have 3 million? I think it was 3 million. And on June 24th, 1940, Heydrich wrote to Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop. He wrote this, quote, "Since the acquisition of the task by my office on 1st January 1939, 200,000 Jews have been emigrated from the Reich. The overall problem already is about 3.25 million Jews are in the area of today's German jurisdiction, which can no longer be solved by immigration. A final territorial solution is therefore necessary." This is what Ribbentrop wrote. A final territorial solution is therefore necessary. Of course, to the exterminationists, if they are forced to look at these kinds of reports and records and so on, then they just say, well, they said that, but they meant something else, or they didn't mean it. It's code language and so on. We'll get into the code language in just a few minutes. So with the territorial solution, first the National Socialists considered the Madagascar plan, and that was floating around for a while. But this didn't materialize because the British controlled the sea lanes and they weren't going to allow that to happen. So the Jews, now they decided the Jews could be deported into the occupied Eastern territories because of the war against, what year are we in here? 40. Okay, I'll forget that last part of what I said. I'll just follow what I'm reading here. Jews should now be deported into the occupied Eastern Territories. On February 10th, this would be 41, I think, yes, Fritz Rademacher, head of the Jewish Department in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, sent a letter to Ambassador Bielefeld, Harold Bielefeld, and he said, in August 1940, I gave you, for your records, the design of my unit plan for the final solution of the Jewish question, including the island of Madagascar from France, called for in the peace agreement, but the war against the Soviet Union has now made available other territories for the final solution. So he's calling this territorial move the final solution. Accordingly, the leaders decided that the Jews be deported, not to Madagascar, but to the east. Madagascar thus does not need to be provided for the final solution. Because now they've changed it to the east. Now, this has all been said again and again and again. It's well known, but I'm just going over it real quickly. So now first, and just point out that they are always talking about a territorial solution. The first deportations in November 1941, November, from 8th November to 28th November, 41, transferred a total of at least 66,210 German, Austrian, and Czech Jews to the Eastern Territories. Of 66 transports, 40 of these arrived in Belarus, 23 in Latvia, 2 in Lithuania and Estonia. These deportations are completely inexplicable from the standpoint of Orthodox historians because, according to them, 6 extermination camps were put into operation from December 1941. By October, November of 1942, all were running and up to speed. This is the Orthodox historian history of it. So they don't know what to make of these other deportations and transports, and they just ignore them. Is what I think they do. So he says, why were these 66 transports sent into the Eastern Territories and not to one of those killing sites, one of those killing plants, Jürgen Graf asked. Well, he says, to questions of this kind, capable Holocaust historians can give no answer. When you ask them this question, they don't answer. And these are, he calls them capable, meaning they're fully operational, these Holocaust historians, about everything else, so they should be able to respond to that too, but they don't. Now, the 3 transit camps, Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka, were equipped with washing and delousing facilities, as well as barracks for the storage of the deportees' possessions that were removed from them in the Eastern Territories. These transit camps were also, Chelmo was also, northwest of Lodz was also included, along with Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. But here's where this Fritz Reuter comes in that David Cole was mentioning. On March 17th, 1942, as an employee in the Office of the General Governors of the Lublin District, Fritz Reuter wrote a note in which he referred to the day before. He was writing to Hermann Hoefele, the famous Hoefele telegram, who was the commissioner for the resettlement of the Jews in the Lublin district. And Reuter wrote, he, meaning Hoefele, concluded he could every day, maybe he was writing about a meeting with Hoefele the day before, that's what this means. And then he wrote a note about his meeting with Hoefele. And he said Hoefele concluded he could every day accommodate 5 transports of 1,000 Jews with the target station Belzec, going to Belzec. These Jews would cross the border and would never return to the general government. So he was going to transport 1,000 Jews, maybe from Belzec, across the border, and they would never return. They were expected to be removed permanently. On July 28, 1942, Albert Gansemüller of the Reichsbahn wrote to Himmler's adjutant, Karl Wolff, since 22nd July, 7 days, for 7 days a train with every, for 7 days since 22nd July, I think, a train with 5,000 Jews from Warsaw to Treblinka, over Malkinia, that's where that train with 5,000 Jews went. Came from Warsaw and went to Treblinka. On August 13th, Wolff replied, "I'm particularly pleased to have gained the knowledge from your message that now a daily train with 5,000 members of the chosen people traveling to Treblinka, and we are still displaced in this way in the situation. We are to perform this population movement in an accelerated pace." Well, I can't translate that all that well, but he's saying that they were moving, this is a population movement, and it was moving along with 5,000 from Warsaw to Treblinka. And then, well, that's not too clear, actually. But it's supposed to mean that they're moving people to the east. And on 5th July 1943, Himmler ordered a circular letter that said, "The transit camp Sobibor in the Lublin district is to be converted into a concentration camp as like an ammunition factory." I'm not sure what that means, but he's in 1943, you see, July 1943, it was converted to a concentration camp rather than no more transits going on from there. The Orthodox historians explain such documents is that the Nazi leaders had used a code language in the transit camp. The transit camp was a cover word for death camp. Population movement is a code name for killing. And to cross the border is a cover word for to be exterminated. So these messages, which I haven't done a very good job in describing, referred to the transit camps, referred to population movements, and referred to crossing the border. And the Orthodox historians, in order not to take that into consideration, just say that this is a code language. I mean, they didn't. What they said is not what they meant. They meant something else. Now, what can't you do in the way of falsifying history if you can invent your own meaning for commonly used words? They wrote something. This was clear what these words mean, and the Orthodox historians simply say, "Well, that's not what they meant. They meant something else." And they can only prove it. They can't prove it, but they can only, in a sense, in their mind, prove it by saying, "But you see how it turned out. We know that they actually killed all these people, so therefore, this is what they really meant." Well, you know, they're taking the conclusion, the assumption that they were all exterminated, and then working backwards to redefining what they were saying, what their words meant. That's not the scientific method, and that's not honest, and it's not the way you go about it. Now, here about the Corhair report, called a key document of April 1943. It said, as you know, a total of 1,274,166 Jews were conveyed through the camps of in the general government through here. The Hufle radio message confirms this number. Now, you know, these are not too different. As far as I know, these are not two different sources for this number. But that the one, probably the Hufle telegram, or radio message it's called here, relied on the Corhair report. That's where they got that number from there. So it's really one source, I would say, for that number. And yet, if it was used, if they find it used again, then that confirms it. In their opinion. So this proves that the regular camp Lublin Majdanek temporarily possessed an additional function as a transit camp, because it was listed on the transports of the Corhair report. And while Belzec was closed in late 1942, Treblinka and Sobibor continued until autumn 1943. So in 1943, there reached a maximum of 86,000 Jews to Treblinka, a maximum of 69,000 Jews to Sobibor, that's what it's got there. Now, think about that. The Belzec was already closed in 1942. Somewhere I've got those dates real clear. Treblinka, for one thing, was only in operation for 8 months. 8 months, and they supposedly mass murdered and made to disappear between 800,000 and 900,000 human beings. Unbelievable. And see, that in itself is not believable. And there's no way, nobody has ever showed how it was done. And this is what Faurisson's great contribution, which I'm going to get into, is that he was among the first or the most convincing who brought up the scientific angle as to and the technical angle as to how was this accomplished, how did these gas chambers work. And when that started being looked into, then's when everything in the whole business changed, and also the Holocaust industry had to come up with new defenses. And one of the things they finally came up with was to just use law and make it illegal to ask these questions or to talk about it or what have you, because they could not ever answer any of that. But let's go on here. There are a large number of documents that show the presence of French, Belgian, and Dutch Jews in the occupied Eastern territories. This is the result of the work of Thomas Cues, along with Matonio and Graf. But according to the Orthodox historiography, however, no Jews should be coming from these countries into the occupied Soviet territories. But they did. There's documents that show that they were there. Graf says, I make mention in the book the hypothesis that the Soviet government denied to the Western Jews who survived the harsh conditions of the war to return to their homeland. That is, that after the war, the Jews who came from the West who were in the Soviet Union were denied the right to leave and return. And as we know, up to or maybe over even a million of them were eventually sent to camps, rounded up and sent to camps in Siberia. So they were not allowed to leave, and they were never heard from again, really. So that's what happened to a lot of them. But one of the strongest pieces of evidence of this is a report in the French communist underground magazine, Notre Voix, or maybe that's Our Voice or Our Something, is released, the French communist underground magazine, released in April of 1944, and referred to a broadcast by Radio Moscow, according to the Red Army in the Ukraine, that they had freed 8,000 Parisian Jews after the German retreat. See? And throughout the Holocaust literature, there was only one word of the return of Jews to France. It's nowhere mentioned that there was any return of Jews to France. But in this communist underground magazine said that Radio Moscow had broadcast that the Red Army had freed 8,000 Parisian Jews in the Ukraine after the German retreat, but they didn't go back to France. They stayed there. They had to stay there, or they were sent somewhere else if they were put into camps, because Stalin, as I've talked about previously, Stalin didn't trust any of these Jews, and he didn't want them to leave his territory, as they might, I don't know, they might turn out to be spies, or they might turn out to say things that he didn't want said, or they might talk about things he didn't want talked about, whatever. He just treated, that's how he treated people on a mass scale, that he didn't trust them, and so he was going to do away with them, or put them into these camps up in Siberia. Now, also, it said that Thomas Cuse has collected further material than was put in that last book they had relating to Western Jews allegedly gassed in extermination camps. And what Thomas Cuse finds and what he looks for, too, is largely derived from Jewish sources. These are messages in which the destinations of the deportees are often given exactly in these Jewish and communist sources. So far, around 60 sources he has for all of this. And Graf says that Cuse has gradually robbed the Holocaust historians of their last viable argument, which is what has become of the Jews if they have not been gassed. So really, they're not all exactly accounted for, but they're beginning to be. And there's still a lot of research to be done, if it can be done. It's, you know, these people have problems, these revisionists, they have health problems and different things. There's nobody but Thomas Cuse doing this kind of work, and he's already kind of, you know, it's like he's into it and he understands what he's doing, and he's the one that needs to continue with it. Hopefully he will be able to continue with it. But this is something altogether new. And the big argument has been all along, well, the reason we know these Jews were exterminated in the Action Reinhardt camps is because we don't know what has become of them. And David Cole used the word disappeared. He says they disappeared. They're gone. So where could they have gone? So there's a lot of work to be done in this area, but progress has been made. That's for sure. Now, a little bit here about the reports of wartime propaganda. I don't want to go into that. That's all. I'm not going to go into that part of it. I will read this. Apart from some small Jewish transports who were transferred from these camps to Majdanek, well, now I'm reading this to myself. I'm trying to figure out whether Okay, here we go. The number and size of the gas chambers in the East. First of the three extermination camps put into operation in March 1942 was Belzec. March 1942, Belzec was the first one to be put into operation. And it started out with a building of 12 by 8 meters in size for a gasification building. And there were three 8-meter long and 4-meter wide chambers, separate chambers in this building. The total area was 96 square meters. And then the question is why it should have been thought to be a good idea to subdivide this building into three chambers and to complicate the gassing process is not clear. But when the SS realized that, now this is the orthodox story that David Cole believes in, when the SS realized that the floor space was too small, they tore the building completely. They tore the building that was already completed in July 1942 and replaced it with a new one, which had six gas chambers at four by five meters. And so the floor space grew by at least 120 square meters. Now, that's not a very much of an increase from 96 square meters to 120 square meters. Now, how stupid were they? And he says, had the SS men not been so stupid to take down the first building, they would have had 216 square meters available if they left the first building up and just built another one. But no, it said, according to what they've, I suppose what these, maybe it's what these witnesses have said, they tore that first building down and enlarged it. So they only gained 24 square meters in the process of all that. It's really stupid. It's really unbelievably ignorant. In May 1942, the second camp was opened, Sobibor. The first one, as I said, was March 1942, Belzec. And May, just a couple months later, May 1942, Sobibor opened. And it was, again, they had a gassing building with three gas chambers, 4 by 4 meters. And then the SS realized it wasn't big enough and the chambers were too small to put the number of people they wanted in there. So they extended the building by adding three also. This time they just added onto this building. They didn't tear it down. So they had six chambers. But then it says that was not enough either. So they built a third one in Treblinka, and on July 23rd, 1942, that opened. So that's just a few months later. So it started in March, and the last one opened in July 42. And also here, it started with three chambers. 4 by 4 meters proved to be insufficient, and they started at the end of August with the construction of a second building with 10 gas chambers, each 8 by 4 meters in size. And by October 1942, that was completed. So in October 42, all three camps were going, and well, of course, if they hadn't made all those mistakes, they wouldn't have had to even had the third camp. But they did. Now, the other thing is that there were no crematoria in the Reinhardt camps. Everybody agrees on that. And yet, in camps such as Dachau, Buchenwald, others, well, for which no mass killings are alleged, they did have crematories. Why wouldn't they have crematories? They really needed crematories in these three camps, but they're very small, and they never built anything like that there. So then they had this huge problem of what to do with these. They obviously, there was these camps did, which really were transit camps, were not expected to be exterminating hundreds of thousands of Jews, and so therefore they didn't have the facilities for it, and because and it never really happened. But the story is that it did happen. But when you try to explain how in the time that they were open, they were able to do all that, it's impossible. I don't want to go through all this. And some of this was taking place in the winter time, in the winter months. For example, in Treblinka, the change that they decided that they had to dig up the ones they had buried and burned them, they decided to do this only in February 1943, at a time when, you know, it would be cold there, and the ground would be, if not frozen, it would be cold, and there were already 700,000 dead Jews under the ground. So in February 1943. And they left... where do I have that? When the camps closed down in 43. So, anyway, that's all. It doesn't add up, and they never have to, David Cole should have to explain all that, but he doesn't. He doesn't go into that. Now, moving along. Okay, and then, of course, there's the volume in the graves. I think, you know, this has been gone over many times. The size of the graves, and they're not big enough for all those, for 800,000 Jews in Treblinka. You know, there are many more Jews supposedly exterminated at Treblinka than at either Belzec or Sobibor, and yet they are larger camps in size than Treblinka, which was the smallest. And after the, Forison says that later on, the administrators forced the sale of land around Treblinka so they could enlarge it and make it look larger to fit the story that they had. So let's go on to, boy, there's a lot of this here, but let's go on to Robert Forison before I run out of time, because he is really the star that I want to focus on. He is, you know, his work has been so crucial, and so, not just so great and so amazing, but crucial to the development of Holocaust revisionism and to where it, how it grew to become what it is today, and to really overthrow the Holocaust industry, so that the Holocaust industry had to shut down to change their attitude toward revisionism, to refuse to talk to them, to arrest them, to call them criminals, to make it impossible for them to, you know, speak, or never, they would never decide never to debate them, not to allow them to put forth any of their evidence in courts of law and things like that. I mean, it caused this repression, and they say Robert Forison was in large part responsible for that, beginning in France. And you could say, well, look what he brought on, and yet that's what happens when you're successful. When you're doing the job you're supposed to be doing, or you want to do, then they come down and really put the boot on you. But that just shows, and Forison has always said that that shows that he is right, and that revisionism is right, and so on. And Forison, I want to say, is a, you know, everybody, you know, we all have different personalities, and you can kind of classify people sometimes into certain types of personalities. And Robert Faurisson has been called a difficult personality. I can't grasp that myself, because I think he's the ideal personality. But obviously he's a fighter. He has that fighting spirit in his personality. Not everybody does, and people who do very good work, scholarly work, and who are on the side of the revisionists wholeheartedly, and are not people who back down or anything, but they don't have that kind of fighting spirit, or sometimes it would be spoken of as aggressiveness that Robert Faurisson has. I like that myself, because I'm that way myself. But he's also a scholar of such great repute, you know, and he's so careful in his work, and he's so exact. In fact, when they wrote this this book, when they put out this fest strip for him, they called it, wasn't it called Exactitude? I think that's what it is. Because that's the hallmark of Robert Faurisson in his revisionist work, and in all the work he's probably ever done, is exactitude. But at the same time, he's this fighter. But he never loses sight of making sure that he's right and that he's got everything in line. So I was reading some of his writings. And he doesn't have, like, a lot of books like some revisionists do. And, like, Carlo Mantegna maybe has the most books of all. I don't know, but he has a lot of books. But Robert Faurisson has done more work than we might realize, because it's not all put in books, although there is a four-volume collection of supposedly everything, or close to everything. But I don't know if it's in English, if it's been put into English, see. But he's written this great book critiquing Jean-Claude Pressac's book, Technique and Operation of the Gas Chambers. And, of course, Faurisson is known mostly for his work on gas chambers. But I found that he had written something that he had actually made a trip to Treblinka, and he had written about it. Now, where is that? My gosh. Oh, I have to go there to read it. That's why. Yeah. It's called Treblinka, An Exceptional Guide. It was in 1988. I'm going to tell you about this because the subject we're talking about is Treblinka. But he also he's done great work on the gas chambers, great work on Auschwitz, great work on Anne Frank, and lots of subjects that not everybody might be aware of. But what I'm going to spend, might take the rest of the time, is to read passages from his report that he wrote, and he has pictures too, and you can find it in several, if you just Google Robert Faurisson Treblinka, you'll come up with some of these selections. And so this was in 1988, he went to Treblinka, and I'm going to start here in part three, where he writes about the exceptional witness that he found, a Polish man named Marian Olszuk. And you see pictures here of Faurisson and the two people he traveled with, so that this was his idea. He didn't go with any other revisionists. He went with a German man named Tijudar Rudolph, who was his interpreter and draftsman, because they did drawings. He was doing drawings and scale drawings and so on of Treblinka. And a young Canadian, Eugen Ernst, who was the cameraman and photographer. And he did a real, what you call investigative trip here. And he said that it was paid for by Ernst Sundel, who covered their travel and accommodation expenses. That Ernst Sundel has been the most generous man. And when he had money, and he was making good money then, he was financing a lot of revisionists doing important work. So, Forison writes, at Treblinka, it was my good fortune, it was my good fortune to find Marion Olszuk, an exceptional witness and indeed a guide. Born in nearby Volka Oraglik, he was 63 years old. In 1942-43, at the period I was investigating, he was 17 and 18 years of age. And he was saying that his ideal witness, he thought that he could find there would be someone who was under 20 years old during the time that this was going on. Or around that age. And so he did happen to come across this man who was 17 and 18 years old at that time, who was willing to speak to him very openly. Robert says, one could hardly imagine finding anyone who might have lived closer to the two Treblinka camps. From December 1941 to July 1944, the Treblinka 1 camp, located quite close to a sand and gravel quarry that supplied Warsaw, was a prison camp mainly for Poles, both Jewish or non-Jewish, who had been found guilty of breaking laws of the German occupation authorities. The nearby Treblinka 2 camp was, from July 23, 1942 to October 1944, a little over 2 years, a camp reserved for Jews. Now, what I said it was, the gassing supposedly, the extermination went on for 8 months there, but the camp was still there. I don't know. I may have made a mistake here. I always have to figure these things out after the show's over because somehow I don't see them ahead of time. According to legend, this was, in the jargon of the Allies, an extermination camp. According to the Encyclopedia of the Holocaust, at least 870,000 Jews were exterminated over a nine-month period, thank you, Mr. Forison, from late July 1942 to April 1943. See, you get confused about these camps because there are three of them. They have different dates, and then it says that the camp was operational until July 1944, but it was not a extermination camp that whole time, according to the Orthodox. So he's just pointing out what was supposed to have been going on there during those 9 months. However, he says this Marion Olszuk was belonged to a family of eight children. He worked every day in the quarry with other Poles. The quarry was not a part of the camp. I guess there was a quarry nearby. It might have been sort of a part of the camp, but outside people worked there. And he was more or less free to, all these workers there were free to come and go as they liked, alongside the prisoners that were watched over. So some prisoners worked there too. Watched over by German soldiers armed with pistols or by Ukrainian guards with carbines. Marion's father was a lumberjack. In the evenings, the young man returned to the family farm, which was a mile and a quarter north of Treblinka, too. Often he would go to the field owned by his father that was just 300 meters from the barbed wire of the eastern perimeter of the alleged extermination camp. The soil was poor, and his family grew rye and lupin there. Passing by the foot of a watchtower, the young Marion would sometimes strike up a conversation with the sentries, who, companionable enough, would now and then toss him a cigarette from on high. The camp was small, covering only between 13 and 14 hectares. By contrast, the Oranienburg-Sachsenhausen, or Sachsenhausen camp, north of Berlin, covered 388 hectares. See, a big camp like Sachsenhausen was 388, whereas this little Treblinka thing was only 13 or 14 between. In 1942-43, the farm folk and passers-by could easily observe through the barbed wire fence the prisoners and the guards, as well as the various buildings of a camp that is now said to have been ultra-secret. Remember what Cole has been, what I talked about that Cole was saying earlier, that this was a big, big secret of the Reich, more so than anywhere else. But he is proving here, because he's got this, found this excellent witness who lived there, that this was not the case. From the perspective of someone facing the entrance to the camp, the Olszuk family farm was located, a mile and a quarter to the left, while their plot lay to the immediate right, 300 meters from the camp's eastern limit. Thus, Marion Olszuk passed close by the extermination camp, in quotes, every day that he went to work at the quarry, and when he worked on the family plot, he was also right near the alleged extermination camp. Even though, of course, he never entered the camp area, every day people gathered in groups outside the front gate, openly engaging in barter and black market dealing. Traffickers came from Warsaw to sell goods to the Ukrainian guards, who in turn would do business with the Jewish prisoners, to whom they sold food. Some of those Jews bought ham and sausages, which were luxury items at that time. The existence of the two camps at Treblinka was common knowledge, and a good many of the Jewish inmates seemed to have money, gold, or jewelry to use in order to buy food and things that they wanted. Had Marion Olszuk ever noticed signs of homicidal activities by the Germans in this extermination camp? His answer was no. Once he had seen a big fire blazing, and there's pictures of this man, and of Forison and his two companions, and also of this female guide that they had, along with this article here at Whale. This is the one at whale.to, Treblinka 2. I don't know. You'll find it. And I'll link to it. Now, let's see. Where did I leave off? He says, no, he has never seen any homicidal activities. Once he had seen a big fire blazing within, but it turned out to be a mound of old clothing about 4 meters high in flames. He never saw any burning corpses. All the same, several times he heard at night the cries and wailings of women and children that reached his farm. Now and then, he related, a ghastly stench emanated from the camp. Had Olszuk ever heard talk of gas chambers? Yes, he had met a Russian who told him that the Germans used a mobile gas chamber on rails. He knew the Germans executed condemned prisoners by firing squad near Treblinka 1. In his movements about, the young worker farmer often happened upon Jews who were housed in the Treblinka 2 camp. Those Jews worked at various tasks in the woods, supervised by Ukrainian guards who, for their part, often deserted. The food was appalling, they said. His own work, Olszuk told me, was to load by shovel small trucks or wagons with sand or gravel 8 hours a day. That was his job as a young fellow. The work was, but he got paid for it. The work was particularly hard going in the winter cold. Personally, he had never seen a Jew being killed. One day, his father gave clothes to a Jew who had escaped from the camp. Convoys of Jews arrived every day. When he was finally called up for work in Prussia, Marion fled, finding refuge in Warsaw and returning to the farm only after the camps had been shut down. He recalled that common graves were dug up and that gold and rubies were found among the human remains. Remarkably, after the liberation of Poland, so these people were buried sometimes with gold and jewels on them, and the Poles were digging around trying to find anything that they could find. Remarkably, but these were not big mass graves at all. Remarkably, after the liberation of Poland and after the war, no administrative or police authority questioned him, our friend Marion, about what had taken place at Treblinka. After the war, there were official commissions of inquiry which issued extravagant reports comparable to the Soviet report on Katyn, but none of those commissions ever asked the Oljuks, anyone in the Oljuk family, to testify. There was quite a number of children in that family. All the same, the official camp guide, this is the woman he had there, the official camp guide, Marya Pisarek, coldly asserted in 1988 to them that no one in the vicinity will talk to you. But Marion Oljuk obviously was able and willing to talk to us at length, and unlike another Polish witness, clear-headedly. Well, he's going to, this other Polish witness was one of the drunkard who was featured in the film Shoah when we get to that. Now, the false dimensions of the extermination camp. For our investigation, I had insisted that our small team should bring along a surveyor's chain. I'm going to have to just start giving the information out rather than reading all this. But they on the second day of their taking measurements of the camp, this Marion Oljuk had agreed to show them the real dimensions of the extermination camp, in quotes, because, you know, they had enlarged the camp after the war and made it, bought up parcels of land and made it larger. And so Cole says, with a video camera recording it all, we accompanied him from one end to the other. I believe I may rightly say that simply by watching his movements, we observed a real man of the soil, someone who is remembering before our eyes, more than 40 years later, every detail of the terrain. Trees and bushes had grown up where formerly the land was practically bare. When he came upon a tree, sometimes he wondered whether the camp's boundary ran to the left or right of it. It was impressive to observe the weathered farmer stop, reflect, and make his decision. The video recorded those moments. It was in the course of this walk that our man gave us a revelation. The camp had, in reality, been smaller in size than what the tourists are told. In 1947, after the war, the authorities bought small abutting parcels of land to, in effect, enlarge the quote, extermination camp, unquote. The first family to be thus expropriated had been that of Franciszek Pawlowski, and the second, the Oljuks, who had only to part with an area of 2,500 square meters. In the attached drawing made by Rudolph, there, Teodor Rudolph, with what means we had on hand at the time, one will note the difference in area between the actual camp of 1942-1943, which covered about 14 hectares, and the 1988 camp that they, when they were there, which was about 23 hectares in size. So they increased it from 14 to 23. At the conclusion, this is really important, I would think. At the conclusion of this visit, Mary and Olship took leave of us, and they were not able to connect with him again because, as it turned out, they had been reported, and the museum deputy curator showed up and was angry at them, telling them that he had never in his life seen such doings as theirs. And Forreston was able to tell him that they were trying to measure the dimensions precisely to better gauge what the prisoners of Treblinka had endured. And he fell for that, and he got calm and smiled and said, well, we need people like you. And they soon became almost friends of his. He's got his pictures in here, too. And so they were able to continue, but they were afraid after that to try to contact their friend Marion, because they didn't want to get him in trouble. And they had heard that he had already been reported by some people in the area to the authorities for having, you know, associating with them. So they never didn't see him again. But the other person he was referring to was one of Claude Lanzmann's most prominent witnesses, Henrik Gawkowski, who was the train driver in the film Shoah, where he was driving an engine. He leans out the cabin door and runs a finger across his throat as he directs that gesture toward the space formerly occupied by the Jews as a sign that they're about to be killed. So he's quite the actor, you know, and he played it up. And when they went to see him, he was giving them a bunch of big stories, you know, that they knew weren't correct. And he also spoke fondly about Lanzmann, saying that he had supplied him with such fine Spanish wine. So Lanzmann was giving him all the booze he wanted, so he would, you know, tell him the stories that he wanted to hear. And now he was telling Forreston and his group that those stories. And Forreston says Forreston always knows how to ask questions. And he asked him, but then, were you aware of taking all those Jews to their death day after day and over a period of nearly 15 months? Because he was driving the train, see. And this man burst out, no, of course not. And Forreston asked him at what moment he became aware of the killings were going on. And this man said, after the war. So you see, he didn't know any of that before, but he says that probably to Lanzmann, but now he's not going to admit it, that he was aware that he was driving people to their death. No, I didn't know that. I just found out after the war. So Forreston writes, in other words, to take up the parable of the American revisionist Arthur Butz, Gawkowski was another of those who at the time had not seen the elephant. He had neither seen it nor heard it trumpet, but a good while later had become convinced that in this particular corner of Poland, a monstrous pachyderm had for nearly 15 months secretly haunted the area, spreading terror as it went. Enough to make one think that the elephant was magical, unless it were only a mirage. Well, finally, he writes about that the extermination camp was actually a transit camp. And he said, to understand, well, I'm not going to read all that. He says, in like manner, in order to gauge the extent to which the prodigious secret exterminations and burials of Jews at Treblinka are but a lie, it is enough to cover on foot today the quadrilateral once formed by the camp, he means the original size one, and to note its modest proportions, about 248 meters by 372 meters by 468 meters by 472 meters. Revisionists can obviously present many additional arguments, going over the testimonies, the admissions, the confessions, the trials in the books, for which a reader with a bit of alertness, the Jewish accusations concerning the Treblinka camp continually show themselves to be illusory and false. Amusement may be found in the 1946 Nuremberg trial, in which the Soviet prosecutor produced evidence supposedly showing a diagram of Treblinka. At this time, a witness spoke of a crematory oven located in Treblinka, where it is admitted that there never was a crematory oven. And according to a document, the International Military Tribunal's view stated facts of common knowledge, that there had been only steam chambers and no gas chamber. Oh, boy. And Forreston says you can go through all of this, it's interesting and also even amusing because it's so ridiculous. But he says, personally, I prefer to spare my readers a repertory of my heaps of files, particularly on Treblinka, giving here only this account of our visit to the camp in the company of a first-rate guide, the Pole Marian Olszuk. I think that's pretty much the end of that. It's really too bad he wasn't able to communicate with this Olszuk more. He says that when in 2000, Jürgen Graf was asked him, Robert Forreston, he was preparing his own visit to Treblinka with Carlo Mutonio, and he asked him, he asked Robert Forreston for advice in preparing for this, and Robert suggested that he visit him in Paris to consult his documents, and he asked him to get in touch once he was there with Marian Olszuk, and he sent him some photographs, but Graf was not able to go to France, and when he visited Treblinka, he did not look up, according to Forreston. The best witness in Forreston's opinion, which was Marian Olszuk. So I don't know what the reason might be or what else they were doing, but it's too bad that we didn't get more from this man who seemed to be giving an honest, and things like that are pretty convincing, you know, that he lived there and he was around there the whole time and he saw it all the time and didn't see anything like what is said. So I think that's very strong. I guess some people think that if you're these so-called eyewitnesses, they think if they say things, you have to believe it. I don't know, but you know what this Marian says sounds believable, but what these Jewish eyewitnesses say don't sound believable. They sound crazy. So, that's the difference there. Well, speaking about Robert Forreston, a little bit more, where is that? He is now 85 years old. Unfortunately, he's not supposed to be in the best of health, but I hope he's going to do some more writing in response to some of this Treblinka stuff coming from Cole. He probably feels he's done enough. How many times can you tell can you say things about it? You don't have to keep repeating yourself. But in any event, on his 75th birthday, he was, all his revisionist friends put out this book called A Festschrift for Robert Forreston, which is a celebration of his achievements, is that's what that is called, of an academic person. And so they all wrote something, and I was reading from that. I thought it was just very, very interesting, but then I found this thing on Treblinka, which I thought I had better use, for today's program. So the editors of this were Germar Rudolph and Robert Countess and that Lintner fellow who has now gone back to being a Holocaust, Orthodox Holocaust believer. Don't ask me why. Nobody can figure out why these people do this. But anyway, there are some very interesting things written in there. I haven't read it all yet, but I hope to read the rest of it eventually, because they all give their own version, their own experience with Robert Faurisson, and of course they want to say good things, but there's critical things in there too, or not even so much critical, but just, you know, it's not all just praise. Carlo Mutonio says that as highly as he thinks of Robert Faurisson, he's had some differences with him, and of course I realize there are some differences. I actually go along with Faurisson on just about everything all the time because he comes out the most strongly and he does not give in. And it doesn't matter what they do to him. He will not say something that he doesn't think is true. And he is the one who holds and believes that and has said that the Holocaust is a falsehood. It's not an exaggeration. This is something that I remember. It's not an exaggeration. It's a total falsehood from the start. And see, that's a way of speaking that a lot of them won't speak that way for whatever reason. But there's a difference of personality, see, as I talked about. That's really come home to me in preparing for this program, that some personalities just aren't, well, they're not confrontative, and they're looking for agreement, or they're looking for, they have the idea that we can somehow all come to some compromise, not a compromise, but we can all come to some agreement eventually. I don't see it that way, and I don't think Robert Faurisson sees it that way. I don't know the man. I wish I did, but I did have him on my program once. I'm so glad that that worked out, and his translator helped me put that together, and yeah, I think I was still on Voice of Reason, and I had Dr. Faurisson was a guest on my program, and he was just excellent. He said some things that I didn't know about and hadn't prepared to ask him about, and so he just really gave us a good interview. But he has. He is very certain, and he's also very careful and knows what he's talking about. But when he sees, well, I'm going to have to say goodnight now, ladies and gentlemen. So kudos to Robert Faurisson, who is the Mr. Good of tonight's program in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And this is Carolyn Yeager saying goodnight for the Heretics Hour, and see you next week.